you're behind.
This episode of the House of Mystery is brought to you by Legacy Food Storage. The best way to protect your family is by being prepared. LegacyFoodStorage.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, Tom Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
106.5 FM Los Angeles, 102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren. Mr. Michael Hawley is here.
Hello, Al.
Hey, you just barely made it.
Oh, yeah. It was a close call, but I got a substitute, so I got to be here.
Yeah, and what's this? Now, I keep seeing pictures of 6 feet of snow in Buffalo.
Oh, yeah, not anymore. Most of it's melted, but in the south towns of Buffalo, it was we got the lake effect, and people don't understand what lake effect is until they live near one of the Great Lakes, and it was truly 6 feet of snow over the weekend.
Yeah, yeah. But you don't stay cold there, so it goes away, doesn't it?
Right now, I think most of it's been melted. Yeah, we're around 40 degrees. We'll get to below freezing a little bit and at the beginning of December. But, yeah, it doesn't get as cold as, like, when you go in the center, you know, like yeah. Minnesota or something.
Right, right. So it's the same around our lake here, too, right? And you get it, and then it kind of melts off. So it's kind of good, in a sense. Oh, and you've got your big truck, hey?
Oh, yeah, my brand-new truck. You betcha.
It's the big man truck.
Yep, I'm a truck owner now.
Okay, well, today we are going back, just like we were doing this last week and a couple other weeks, we cover, and you're good with this, you're Mr. Jack the Ripper. So.
Oh, yes, I love it. I'm excited to talk to Richard.
Yeah, so we're going to be talking to a lifelong Sherlockian. And this time we have Mr. Richard T. Ryan. So welcome to the show, Richard.
Hey, Al. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Nice speaking with you.
Nice to you too, Michael.
Well, Richard, I have to, I always wonder where one begins this journey of being a lifelong Sherlockian. So this is from the get-go?
I actually discovered Sherlock Holmes and began to take him seriously when I was a graduate student at the University of Notre Dame. And I've delved into it. I've read the entire canon several times over, but it began at Notre Dame. And then back in the 80s, I wrote a Sherlock Holmes trivia book. And then I was getting ready to retire from the newspaper industry. I'd worked 30 years as a newspaper man, and I'd always wanted to write a book. And Sherlock Holmes just seemed like a natural.
What is it about Sherlock Holmes that is so fascinating to you, that keeps you involved in it for so many years?
Well, I think you have a character that's not a superhero. You know, he's a normal, you know, everyday individual, obviously a lot smarter than most people. And it's the creation and the way he uses his mental abilities and the partnership with Watson that are all endearing facets, you know, of this character and his relationship with his, you know, with his best friend.
Do you like that the way that different places, you know, television and movies and sometimes writers change who Sherlock Holmes is and even Watson?
Yeah, I'm not averse to it. It was one of my favorite TV shows was Elementary with, you know, Jenny Lee Miller playing Holmes as a recovering drug addict, which he kind of is in the Doyle novels. Obviously, they took the the liberty of turning Watson into a woman, which I'm fine with. You know, there's a million different permutations of Sherlock Holmes. And my own gut feeling is, and the analogy I always use is like a coloring book. You know, I don't care what colors you use, but I would like you to stay within the line.
Yeah.
So when they take Holmes to the extremes, that's something I'm not comfortable with. That's something I'm not fond of. But as long as it's a recognizable Holmes on the page and a recognizable Watson on the page, I mean, I'm fond of the Benedict Cumberbatch series. I have no problems with moving it up to contemporary times, you know. But there are certain, you know, if you're going to do Holmes, then do Holmes. Don't do your version of Holmes. Do Doyle's version of Holmes.
Yeah. Well, there's something about it. And the actual mystery in each book, the case that each one it covers, do you find it to be quite unique as far as mystery writing?
Well, Doyle was a master of style. And that's one of the things that I think a lot of people don't appreciate is, you know, all his novels. He wrote four novels. And they're all relatively short. Three of them might even be considered novellas. The longest one is The Hound of the Baskerville. It's about 60,000 words. But, I mean, he's got one that's 42,000 words, 43,000 words, 49,000 words. So, I mean, they're short. And he does in one or two sentences what other authors need to take one or two paragraphs to do. You know, he was Hemingway before Hemingway knew how to write that way.
So what is that to you when you're in the position of being involved in writing, you know, Sherlock Holmes cases?
Well, the first book I wrote was called The Vatican Cameos. And what I did in that book, in two of the Sherlock Holmes novels, they're bipartite. The whole first half of the novel is Sherlock Holmes solving the mystery. And then the second half of the novel is the villain, if you will, giving us his backstory. And then Holmes comes in at the end for the denouement. What I did in the first book was I set all the odd chapters in the 1890s, 1901, I believe it was, and all the even chapters in 1501. You know, I had people saying, this is not a Holmes book. He's only in it for half the book. Well, yeah, but if you look at, you know, The Sign of Four, he's only in it for half the book. If you look at it for A Study in Scarlet, he's only in it for half the book. But the thing that came out of that, where I was getting back to, was a very prominent Sherlockian whom I respect a great deal, liked the book, and he said, you know, it's similar to Doyle's in many respects. He says, the only thing is, if you're going to do Doyle, he says, you know, go with him in length as well. So the next six books I've written have all been rather short. They're in that Doylean range of 50 to 60,000 words. So, you know, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, and I try to imitate Doyle in all aspects.
How does one become what you do? You know, like, is there like a certain test, is there a certain procedure that you've got to go through before you write stories like Sherlock Holmes stories?
No, I think the thing you have to do, if you want to write a Sherlock Holmes story, because he is in public domain, and you certainly can use him as a character, but the thing is, you have to immerse yourself in what's called the canon, the 56 short stories and the four novels. You know, you have to basically know that cold, because Sherlockians are a very discerning audience, and they will call you out on even what they perceive to be the most minute slip. So half of the time I spend when I'm doing a book is spent in research, because the details all have to be right.
Richard, I wanted to be part of this because about a month and a half ago, I did a lecture, a local lecture. I researched Jack the Ripper, but I did a mutual lecture with our local Sherlock Holmes expert, Kevin Gallivan. And so his group, they, so we were speaking together, and the question was always, One question was, is why did Arthur Conan Doyle not have Sherlock Holmes go after Jack the Ripper? But the question was, is if he would have, all those kind of questions between, you know, the fictional person of Sherlock Holmes versus the nonfiction of Jack the Ripper. So I was curious about that because what I was surprised at is that Arthur Conan Doyle did not have Sherlock Holmes kind of go against Jack the Ripper. Any thoughts on that?
As you can imagine, I've read several Holmes and Ripper encounters, for lack of a better word. And I'm starting to think, you know, the more theories that we get about Jack the Ripper, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, you know, there were a number of people that seemed to think that in some way, somehow, the royal family was involved with the Jack the Ripper killings.
Yes.
You know, and there was a book many years ago called Prince Jack that I have downstairs. But I'm almost wondering if Doyle just deliberately stayed away from it so as not to, A, bring any more attention to it than it had already attracted, and B, because somewhere, somehow, it might end up embarrassing, you know, the Victoria and the royal family at that time.
Yeah, that could be. I did discover, find when Arthur Conan Doyle was in Boston, and a reporter asked him in 1894 what would Sherlock Holmes have done with Jack the Ripper. And so it was Arthur Conan Doyle that was convinced that Jack the Ripper was basically, they called him a monomaniac back at the time, but a person that had a disease, basically neurosyphilis. And then but he thought that the letters, some of the Ripper letters, that's what Sherlock Holmes could have used possibly to help out. Sadly, most of those letters are actually fakes, but it's interesting because the guy I researched, the suspect is Francis Tumbley, he had the neurosyphilis. Arthur Conan Doyle was making comments that the Dear Boss letter had Americanisms in it, so it was likely a monomaniac American, and that's exactly what Francis Tumbley was. So my argument at the end with Kevin was, if he would have known who Tumbley was at the time, maybe Sherlock Holmes would have battled Tumbley himself. So that was my fun part of it.
Are you familiar with Dr. H.H. Holmes?
Yes, and the problem with him was that he's a Chicago serial killer.
Right.
That his great-grandson, when he, Jeff Mudgett, when he looked at, he was researching to find out if Holmes was in Chicago during the Ripper killings in the autumn of 1888, he says he wasn't. So then his great-grandson said, therefore he was in, crossed the Atlantic and killed these women. But what happened is he forgot to look at the voting records. He's in the voting records. And then also his daughter was born in July of 1889, which means that he had to have conceived during the middle of the Ripper murders in Chicago, because his wife never left Chicago, unless it's not really his daughter. But so there's a lot of misconceptions when that came about. But,
yeah. No, I've seen his name, you know, considered as a possibility for the Ripper, primarily, I guess, because he was a serial killer.
You know, right.
No one ever takes the time. And then this is, you know, again, when I go back to this, I go back to the details, you know. If I were to do H.H. Holmes and consider him to be Jack the Ripper, believe me, I checked the voting records.
Exactly. And then, but that's for sure. And also the foremost expert in Holmes basically says there's absolutely no evidence that Holmes ever crossed the Atlantic. That's right. But so Sherlock Holmes has gone to America then.
He has.
That is cool.
Yeah, he went to Buffalo and joined an Irish secret society.
Oh, and I know that one because I'm in Buffalo, by the way.
Okay.
And I had to deal with these Irish societies because Tumbley was in Buffalo and he was an Irishman.
Right. And then, you know, then he went back and became Altamont. That was his name in that story.
Oh, okay.
And that was the one with Van Bork.
Hmm.
And it's the one in one of the Rathbone movies. They take the scene and they take the actual lines from the Doyle story, and, you know, Holmes says, there's an east wind coming.
Ah.
You know, and that's, it's really well done. That particular story, I think, is really well done.
Did you ever wonder why Sherlock Holmes has such a lasting power with the public, like over and over and over? I mean, it seems like every decade we have new movies and new books and new versions, and it never seems to end.
It doesn't end, and it's you know, I guess a testament to the skill of Doyle as an author. But as you point out, you know, Robert Downey Jr. has done two movies; he's doing a third. We had the Cumberbatch series. We've had the Elementary series. Recent vintage, you have the Enola Holmes movies.
Right.
They're on Netflix, I believe.
And that's good.
Yeah, it's very good. There was a series on Netflix that was not so good called The Irregulars. But, I mean, you go back, and Holmes has either been on radio and TV almost constantly since, like, the 20s and the 30s. And not only in the English speaking, I mean, there was the whole Russian series. There's a Japanese series, Miss Holmes. I mean, I'm not sure why the appeal is as wide as it is, but there is definitely an appeal there. And people read Holmes and they find something that resonates with them.
Yeah, and it's generational too.
It is generational. You know, and I think what a lot of people who like Holmes do, and I did this to a small degree myself, is they try to, you know, interest their children in it. You know, I wrote an alphabet book called Bees for Baker Street. I have two small grandchildren. And the alphabet book is, you know, geared. It's on little rhymes, but hopefully, you know, my granddaughter is going to be four. My grandson was just two. Hopefully when they get a little bit older, they can kind of read it, appreciate it, and understand, you know, what Sherlock Holmes is about.
So you've written quite a few of these. So how do you choose what you're going to put together and how you're going to put together one of the stories?
You know, there are two types of writers. I'm sure you know. There are plotters and there are pantsers.
Right.
And I'm a pantser. I sit down and I really have just a vague notion of what I'm going to write about. One of the novels that I wrote is called The Merchant of Menace. And at the heart of The Merchant of Menace is a Fabergé egg. And I had always had an abiding interest in Fabergé eggs. I was amazed by them. And that book allowed me to, you know, delve into the history of Fabergé eggs, their construction, where they ended up, and everything else. And a lot of that found its way into my book. And it's just like something will strike me, and it could be the oddest thing, and that's what sets me off.
I find it fascinating, the whole concept. Now, you've got this newest one out that it's called The Poison Pawn.
Right.
And it's Sherlock Holmes Adventure Book Number 14. So let's talk about that. So what's the premise of this?
I'm trying to hedge my bets here because I don't want to give away too much, obviously. The premise is that a young woman comes to Holmes and she says, you know, my brother has disappeared. At the same time, Lestrade comes to Holmes and he says, you know, we found a body in the London Bridge, which was under construction at that time. And it ends up, you know, obviously her brother and the body are the same person. That comes on early in the book. But it develops into a three-dimensional game of chess, if you will, between Holmes and his unknown adversary. And, you know, at several points during the book, you know, Watson tells Holmes, you know, when you're playing chess, you know, if you lose a pawn, you just take it off the board. You know, you lose a piece. He goes, but you're playing with lives and you're playing with people's, you know, destinies. And Holmes says, I'm well aware of that. You know, so he never takes anything for granted. But it became a chess match because I've always enjoyed chess as well. That kind of grew into, you know, two men literally trying to outwit each other.
Have you ever thought about where Sherlock Holmes came from with Doyle? Like, if he was after someone else, created under the image of another person?
Well, the general theory is that he was modeled on one of Doyle's medical school teachers, Dr. Joseph Bell. And they said, you know, one of the things that Bell would do is he would have a beaker of really foul tasting liquid in front of the class. And he would put his finger in, you know, he would dip his finger in and then taste it. And he'd say, okay, I want you all to do the same. And each of his students would come up and he'd say, you know, they would do the same thing. But what Bell did was he put his index finger into the beaker, but he put his middle finger into his mouth to taste it. So he never actually tasted the stuff. And he would tell them, you see, but you do not observe, which is what Holmes is always preaching. You know, we're not paying attention. You see someone stick a finger in a thing of liquid, put it in their mouth, you assume that's the finger that went into the liquid without even thinking about it. So that he appears to be the model for Sherlock Holmes.
His antagonist, Professor Moriarty.
Right.
Have you ever used him, or you shy away from him?
I've used Moriarty. I've had henchmen who, rather than try to one-up Doyle, I've had my villains in the employ of Moriarty, if you will.
Oh, okay.
You know, I mean, Moriarty is a great character who isn't in all that many books. I think he's only referenced in like three short stories and one novel. And, you know, the biggest story that he plays a role in is The Final Problem, where Holmes goes to Switzerland and Moriarty follows him and they have that fight at the Reichenbach Falls. But, you know, he's the number one villain in the canon, you know. And I don't think, you know, it's bad enough I'm stealing Doyle's detective, but I want to steal his villain too.
Now, didn't also Arthur Conan Doyle want to do basically off Sherlock Holmes?
Oh, absolutely. He felt that his historical writings were being neglected because Holmes took so much attention from him. So despite, you know, his mother got very angry at him. He told his mother he was going to kill his Holmes off.
And mom didn't like it.
No, she was very upset. But he did it anyway. And then it was a situation where, you know, as the years went by, publishers just kept coming back to him and basically throwing more money at it.
Speaking of that, Arthur Conan Doyle, that at the beginning, wasn't it that he wanted to kind of not do Sherlock Holmes, so when the publisher came, he said it's going to be a real high level of money, and they gave it to him.
Well, that's how Holmes got brought back. Holmes' origin traces to a dinner. He was at dinner, believe it or not, with Oscar Wilde. And I believe the publisher's name was George Nunez. And he commissioned Doyle and Wilde to write a story for him. And Wilde turned in a picture of Dorian Gray. Uh-huh. And Doyle turned in a study in Scarlet. And, you know, from there he went to the short stories. Because, again, he was a struggling doctor. And, you know, he didn't have a thriving practice by any means. So writing was a way to supplement the income. And then when Holmes took off, then he branched out into his other historical writing. And he wanted to do more of that, but all they wanted was Holmes. So he killed Holmes off. And they kept coming back and throwing more money and more money and more money. And then he wrote The Hound of the Baskervilles, I believe. And what he did, he was smart, because he set that before Holmes perished. So this way he wasn't locked into, he hadn't actually brought him back. He had brought him back to the public, but he hadn't brought him back to life yet. So that came back, and that was a success. And again, all that did was increase the demand for more home stories. So then they came back and they threw two more, you know, bathtubs full of money at him. And he said, okay, fine. And I believe that at one point he was the highest paid author in the world.
Did he know Bram Stoker?
I believe he did.
So how do you go about keeping it fresh, keeping ideas that are still they still resonate with the true Sherlock Holmes and story? But, yeah, how do you keep it fresh?
I think what you have to do is look for something that has not been done before, at least not by Doyle. You know, so as I mentioned, the Fabergé egg, you know, which, you know how valuable they are and what collector's items they are, you know, and that became the focal point. In the Poison Pawn, Holmes never once, to my knowledge, plays chess in the canon. He doesn't play in any of the novels or any of the short stories. And yet you would think someone like Holmes would be an excellent chess player, given the fact that he's always able to be three or four moves ahead of his opponent. And so that became almost a natural kind of motif for that particular story. And in Incidents, the second novel I wrote was The Stone of Destiny. And that involves the Coronation Stone, or the Stone of Scoon. And it's about 360 pounds. And it sat in Westminster Abbey. It was in a chair called the Coronation Chair. And every king of queen of England would have to sit on this chair during the coronation. And then in 1950, a group of students broke into Westminster Abbey on Christmas Day and stole it. And eventually it was recovered. But for the longest time, Great Britain, that was their tradition. And it was a Final Jeopardy question one night, the Stone of Scone. And I remember thinking years later, you know, wouldn't it be interesting? Because, I mean, they raised a large hue and cry when it was stolen. Everyone was out looking for it and everything else. And I remember thinking, you know, wouldn't it be interesting if this had been stolen years earlier and for whatever reason the Crown needed to keep it secret? They didn't want people to know that it had been stolen. So that's the way I structured that Holmes book.
Well, that's interesting. So you just kind of come across the idea and then kind of think, well, that would be interesting.
Exactly.
But how much research, like when you're talking about something like that or like chess playing and stuff, if you're not a chess player yourself, how do you make sure that it sounds like they're having an intelligent game, or do you kind of just avoid it?
No, I have researched things like how fast horses can gallop, how fast they canter. I have researched the ancient Irish alphabet system out of Ogham, O-G-H-A-M. Anything that crosses my mind. The book before this was called Three May Keep a Secret. And I remember reading about this piece of jewelry that had been made using a technique I'd never heard of it before called plique-à-jour, which literally means let the daylight in. And that became the jumping off point for that book with there's a very valuable piece called the Merode Cup. And I began, that deals with a lot of people forging antiquities and, you know, selling them on the market as real pieces. So yeah, I do. I would say if it takes me a year to write a book, 6 months is spent doing research and 6 months is spent in the actual writing.
We interrupt our programming. This is a national emergency. Important details will follow.
Are you prepared? Legacy Food Storage. The best way to protect your family is by being prepared. Go now to legacyfoodstorage.com. Use coupon code HOM15 now for 15% off. Quick, go!
If you're a fan of stories that make you afraid to turn the lights off at night, then you will love Moonless Nocturne, Tales of Dark Fantasy and Horror. From attorney, former Air Force officer, special agent for the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, and Bram Stoker Award-winning author, Hank Schwabel, Moonless Nocturne is a chilling set of 10 tales that offers an exquisite and impressive showcase of the author's talents that are sure to entertain and intrigue readers who love a good thrill. With an introduction by the iconic F. Paul Wilson, Moonless Nocturne is a gourmet platter of both red meat and rare delicacies, not only for aficionados of horror, mystery, thrillers, and suspense, but any connoisseurs of fantastic fiction. It's inventive and original. This collection has already been optioned for television and film by Lone Tree Entertainment and is certain to appeal to fans of King, Barker, Matheson, and Jackson. It's not the dark that should scare you. It's all the things that lurk there. Order your copy right now on Amazon or wherever books are sold. Moonless Nocturne, Tales of Dark Fantasy and Horror. From author Hank Schwabel.
Morning face. You get it when you don't sleep well. This is what happened to Linda.
Morning, guys.
Good morning. Ah, what is that thing?
It's me, Linda.
Oh, my God, it talks! Run!
No, it's me, Linda, from HR.
It looks hungry! Save the children! Save them! Stay back, I've got mace!
Ow, that went in my eyes!
Quit moving!
It's called beauty sleep for a reason. And there's never been a better time to get some.
Get 20% off IKEA Sultan mattresses. IKEA, love your home.
Computer, execute 12.4p operation.
Optimizing algorithm. Running encryption packet alpha 99. Oh, I don't feel so good.
What? What is it, computer?
Is it hot in here? It feels hot in here. I feel a little clammy. I should lie down or something.
A computer with a virus? Surprising. What's not surprising? How much you could save by switching to GEICO.
Those oysters Rockefeller were a mistake.
GEICO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
Look, we know that boy's going to ask again, so let's be ready.
Fine, I'll be him. You ready?
Ready.
Mom, could you hook me up with a GoPhone?
You'll run up the bill, son.
Yo, that's whack, Moms. GoPhone is totally different.
What? It'll only cost me an arm?
Chillax. It has unlimited talk and text.
Seriously?
Word.
Okay, we'll get a GoPhone.
Really? Really? That is the bomb.
Do you even know what the bomb means?
Yes. No.
GoPhone, only from AT&T. With unlimited talk to 65 million wireless AT&T customers, and now unlimited text to anyone on any network. AT&T, your world delivered.
Me, but also you. The Pharaoh fast-forwards his favorite foreign film, Powder Donut. Okay, what's my line?
The only line I see here on the script is get options based on your budget with the name and price tool from Progressive.
Oh, man, that's a tongue twister, huh? I'm sorry, I'm gonna need a few more minutes. Bulbous Walrus, the Bulbous Walrus.
The name your price tool, only from Progressive.
The owl ran afoul of the comatose coxswain.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Now back to the show.
So, doing 14 of these, have you ever noticed maybe an accident that you assumed some of this kind of idea came from Arthur Conan Doyle, then you realize it was actually you from book three? Or something like this, that you're doing a pattern that you actually created as opposed to maybe Arthur Conan Doyle?
No, I can't say I'm that clever.
Oh, come on. Just say it.
I so wish I could. Yeah, and it's not modesty preventing me, trust me.
So when you finish, how is this? When you finish a book,
right.
What does it do for you? Like, what do you get out of doing one of these books?
Well, when you're finished, the first thing you get is an immediate sense of relief. Okay? And then I have a series of beta readers, the toughest of which is my wife. But I give the book to, you know, various beta readers for feedback. And I've been very fortunate, very, very fortunate in that, you know, I know which books of mine are stronger. I know which books are the weaker ones. And knowing that, knowing what you didn't do well in the past, kind of helps you avoid that same pitfall in the future. You know, the ability, you can know your strengths, but you also better know your weaknesses.
Right.
What exactly about it would make it strong, make it as opposed to weak? Like, what makes a good story or a good book?
Well, one of the things that too many books, not just Sherlock Holmes books, but too many books turn on is the idea of coincidence, you know? And I try to avoid coincidence in any way, shape, or form in my books. It just, you know, Romeo and Juliet just doesn't happen that often where, you know, he misses the friar and the friar misses him and he goes into the tomb, stabs himself, and she wakes up shortly after and stabs her. You know, it doesn't work that way. You know, life doesn't turn on coincidence. Life turns on planning. And everything that Holmes does is meticulously planned. And that's the problem with my writing is that, you know, we were talking about this before, plotters and pantsers. I'll be sitting at the computer and I'll be writing and I always have this phrase, wouldn't it be cool if? And then I realize that I can make whatever I think would be cool happen. The problem is then it sometimes takes me 2 to 3 weeks to solve the problem I've just created for myself. You know, once you paint yourself into a corner, it can be difficult to get out.
Well, so what's your favorite one that you've written in the Sherlock Holmes series?
I'm kind of partial to, I'm partial to the Pawn. I'm partial to the Merchant of Menace. My wife's favorite, and it generally seems to be everybody else's favorite, is the Vatican Cameos.
What do you think the difference is? Like, why do you see it different than what a lot of people do?
I think I've grown a little bit as a writer, and I don't think I'm making the same types of mistakes that I made in my earlier books, you know. And, I mean, there are things now, I mean, they're like, the first two books I wrote, the point of view switched back and forth between Holmes and other characters. I don't do that anymore. The last five, Watson has been the narrator and the only narrator. And, you know, that's a struggle because you have to keep him in the book, you know, and he has to be with Holmes, and yet Holmes has to be the focal point. So it's a little bit of a tougher writing process in that respect. But I think the rewards are worth it when you get done.
So we're not listening to Holmes at all. We're listening to Watson.
Well, you're listening to Holmes in dialogue, but, I mean, Watson is the narrator.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of dialogue in the books.
Wow, I think it's fascinating putting something like this together. So, how do you know when you've got the right story? That's a weird question, but in a sense of when you get an idea, like when you had something brewing in your mind, or you hear something and you think about it and you want to apply it to Sherlock Holmes, what makes it right for you? What's the confidence thing?
Yeah, it has to. It's basically a feeling, you know. I wish I could be more specific than that. But there are things that, you know, you watch a movie or you read a book and, you know, you say, yeah, that feels right. And I've had, you know, false starts. And I've started with things that didn't work out the way I had hoped. Or I've started with things and they've gone an entirely different way than I had imagined. And that's part of it. It's got to feel right, you know, as nebulous as that sounds. That's really the answer.
Well, how about the very first book? To me, it's like you're putting so much on your shoulder to be the author of Sherlock Holmes himself. How did that happen?
I mean, had that happened?
It's like, was it you that decided, or did someone ask you to do it? Or
no, I had decided, you know, in the... The beauty of Doyle, and this goes back to an earlier question, is, you know, throughout the canon, throughout his poems and his short stories and novels, he's always referencing other cases that we know nothing about. And that's where the Vatican cameos come from. That's a throwaway line at the beginning of The Hound of the Baskervilles. You know, Dr. Mortimer comes to, you know, call on Holmes. And he says, you know, you may have seen this. And Holmes says, no. He says, I was a little bit preoccupied taking care of that matter of the Vatican cameos for the Pope, so I missed several interesting English cases. And it's a throwaway line. But that throwaway line became, okay, what can I do with that title to turn it into a book?
Oh, wow.
And, you know, some of the throwaway lines are famous, like the giant rat of Sumatra is a throwaway line. You know, that Watson mentions, he said, you know, the world, he said, the world is not ready yet for the tale of the giant rat of Sumatra. And bang, you know, it's a tease. Now, whether Doyle ever intended to write these in the future or not, I don't know. But there are more than 100 untold tales in the canon. You know, he mentions an amateur mendicant society. He mentions the mysterious case of the aluminum crutch, the lighthouse, the politician, and the trained cormorant. You know, so all these things are out there. And some have been picked up and turned into pastiches by other authors. And I happen to choose the Vatican cameos for my first pastiche.
Hmm. How is that? So do you get other authors fighting you over these?
No, I don't. I mean, Holmes today is almost, you know, you had mentioned why he stays. It's almost like he's a cottage industry. You know, they are probably, I would say, conservatively speaking, somewhere between 300 and 500 Holmes titles produced every year. Yeah. And that's not counting, that's just print. That's not counting fan fiction. That's not counting TV or movies or anything else. So, you know, if you want to just up it to 500 and include everything, we can do that.
So are you ever going to change kind of the theme that you do? You kind of keep it back in the old times. Like you have modernized yours. Do you ever plan on doing something wild like that?
Well, I have a book in the back of my mind, and it's been in the back of my mind for probably 4 or 5 years now. And in college and in graduate school, I specialized in medieval literature. And, you know, there's a lot of the medieval period that creeps into my books. And I have this one story from the Middle Ages that I would love to just sit down and turn it into a novel. Well, whether I will or not, that's another whole story. Because that, you know, the great thing about Holmes is the world has been created. You know, the characters are there, the setting is there, and the setting is, you know, very rich. And all you really have to do as an author is, you know, come up with a plot that works, as opposed to creating an entire world.
And I guess, in a way, both Holmes and Watson, their personalities can be changed.
Yes.
Like, not the style of their detective and their behavior, maybe, how they work on cases, but their actual attitudes and feelings and things like that can actually be changed from author to author.
Yes, absolutely. And again, you know, Holmes, as created by Doyle, the later stories, he's a much more human, I don't want to say warmer, but that's the word. He's a warmer individual than he is in the earlier stories. You know, Watson describes Holmes as an automaton, a thinking machine. And in the later stories, that's not nearly so evident.
So you could actually do, you know, like just kind of like how they did it with females, Dr. Watson and stuff. You can.
Sure.
Boy, the world is open.
Yeah. I mean, Holmes, you know, Holmes has been everywhere. There was a cartoon series, Sherlock Holmes in the 23rd century. Holmes has, there's a book out, Sherlock Holmes and the Roswell Incident, you know. A lot of people, a lot of authors have taken him, you know, into World War II, where, you know, he'd kind of be in his 80s or 90s during the World War II. So that, you know, that doesn't quite work. I mean, the World War I would be fine. You know, he'd be near the end of his career, but, you know, he'd be 60. So, okay, if he's a virile 60, that's fine.
One interesting thing that that modern researchers have a better understanding of serial killers than back when I researched the 19th century, that they really did not have a good grasp at all of how the serial killers thought. Do you ever kind of deal with that with Sherlock Holmes, or do you avoid any kind of serial killer?
No, I did my second book. The third book, The Druid of Death, is a serial killer book.
Okay.
You know, so, but you know, it wasn't, it's not random. So, I mean, these are very calculated, carefully planned, carefully orchestrated killings with a purpose in mind.
Okay.
It's not just, you know, random like Jack the Ripper seems to have been.
Now, and in your murders and cases like that, you don't really get into the gore. Like, in typical Sherlock Holmes fashion, it isn't like a descriptive murder, is it?
No, I don't. There are some authors that do, but it, you know, again, you know, I'm trying to be true to Doyle.
Yeah.
And give you what purports to be a Sherlock Holmes story, you know, written by Dr. Watson. So I'm not going to deviate too far from, you know, the written records that Watson has left us.
Do you guys have a group? Is there a Sherlock Holmes writers group? And do you guys do awards and magazines and all that stuff like Jack the Ripper?
Well,
or do you guys know?
There are Sherlock Holmes societies all over the United States. Just about every major city has one, from Los Angeles to Washington to New York, and even a lot of smaller cities have them. But the biggest Sherlock Holmes society is the Baker Street Irregulars. And that's by invitation only. You have to be invited to join that. And yeah. In the history of the Baker Street Irregulars, Isaac Asimov was a Baker Street Irregular. Mickey Spillane was a Baker Street Irregular. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a Baker Street Irregular. You know, so they have this long, distinguished history going back. And they meet once a year in January in New York City to celebrate Sherlock Holmes' birthday. And they have a dinner. New members are invested. You know, there's always a performance of some kind. It's an entire weekend every January dedicated to Sherlock Holmes. And people from all over the world fly in for this.
I realize it's a big festive. They've never invited me.
Well, that's what I was invited to.
I've only recently begun to get invited.
That's what I was invited to in Buffalo, because that's the Buffalo Society, the one in Buffalo with Kevin Gallivan. So, yeah, they're pretty dedicated.
Yeah, must be. Jeez.
Well, as I said, you know, there was the one here in New York was called the Priory Scholars. I know the one in Texas is the Lone Bark. There's the Norwegian Explorers. They're all over. I mean, Minneapolis has a big one. Chicago has a big one. You know, and they do. They hold conferences. They hold symposiums every year.
Wow. That's pretty interesting. Now, for yourself here, do you like to interact with readers or fans and stuff like that? Do you have social media that you like to give out to people, or a website? How do people get a hold of Richard?
Well, the easiest thing, I mean, I have no problem interacting with readers. The easiest way to get hold of the books is Amazon. You know, if you search Richard T. Ryan and add the word Holmes on Amazon, you know, you'll come up with all the books. And then, you know, I'm on Goodreads, so, you know, people message me on Goodreads all the time. And, yeah, I have no problem interacting with readers at all. Enjoy hearing back from them.
So now I should also mention before we go that you also you've done a book on Agatha Christie trivia. What drew you to that?
Well, again, I had it during the summers when I was a teenager. I had a job as a messenger in Manhattan. And a lot of my time was spent either sitting on a bench waiting to deliver something or riding the subways. And I loved mysteries. I would devour mysteries. And at that time, you know, you could get a book for a dollar. And I would, you know, I would buy a book every morning for a dollar. And, you know, I'd have it done by the time I got home, because I had to commute in from Staten Island to Manhattan and then back to Staten Island. So I became an avid reader. I had John Dixon Carr, Agatha Christie, people like that. I just read them constantly, which probably explains why I'm still fascinated by Holmes.
Ellery Queen.
Yeah, the golden age of mystery.
Thing. I think it's much more interesting than modern-day detective mysteries, but that's me. I don't know. Do you enjoy new stuff out there?
Well, I love the Jack Reacher character by Lee Child.
Yeah.
I think that's very, very well done. My other favorite authors include Stephen Hunter. Daniel De Silva, or Daniel Silva, I'm sorry, no, Daniel Silva, and Kyle Mills, who writes the Mitch Rapp series. So those are people that I actually look forward to reading, wait for their books every year.
Do you find a difference between British mystery detectives as opposed to American?
Oh, absolutely.
I ask quite often, and I get usually people that say, yeah, and they'll say their feeling on the two types of mystery writing. But I also get about 30% of writers that say, no, they're the same. So that always fascinates me. I wait for that answer where they say, no, I don't know. It's the same, and it's not, but that's okay. What's your take on the two? What's the big difference?
Well, I think, you know, with the biggest difference is, you know, I have this image in the back of my mind of you don't see the British detectives, you know, going into any place guns blazing, you know. Whereas, you know, American detectives, that seems to be one of their fortes. You know, you think of something like Die Hard with John McClane, who's really a detective, right?
Yeah.
And then you compare it to something like the Helen Mirren series, Prime Suspect. You know, and again, like John Luther, again, with Idris Elba, you know, he's kind of a Sherlock Holmes character, you know, and there's a difference in the way they approach their mysteries. There's a certain gentility to the British characters that Americans don't have.
There's also something I noticed. It's not as dramatic. That's not the right word, but you could take a Sherlock Holmes. You'll learn what you need to about the characters. But it's not so drawn out. I find a lot of American mystery detective shows, especially, it gets too much drama in it. There's way too much stuff going on about the characters, like more than you need to know, and it almost takes away from the mystery.
Well, I think with American, you know, it sounds almost like red herrings, and how do you handle red herrings, you know, and if they're necessary, but you can't overdo it. You can throw in all kinds of distractions, and those distractions can be character based, they can be plot based, they can be setting based, whatever it may happen to be. But you know, the British seem a little bit more straightforward in how they approach things than the Americans do. You know, much more linear. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
So would you mean something like one of the authors that I interviewed with Al? Talked about, usually his characters have some kind of flaw, and then he really works that flaw into that character.
Right.
You say something like that, where they go too far with the flaw or something?
They can, sure. You know, you can carry anything too far. And, you know, I mean, there are books that I've started, you know, that I thought, you know, come highly recommended, I just can't finish. And overwhelmingly, those books are written by American authors.
Yeah. Yeah, there's too much sometimes. You know, you get carried away with, it takes the focus away. It takes the tension away, the suspense away from the actual mystery. If there's too much fluff about the characters, especially the extra characters that really don't matter, you know, but anyway, that's just,
Well, that goes back to one of the things I said earlier with Doyle being this, you know, the economical writer and doing in two sentences what other authors take two paragraphs and maybe in some cases two pages to do.
Yeah, because there's always that, you know, to me, that's what's an amazing writer or a great writer or someone that, you know, they can write a paragraph and you just look at it and you go, God, I wish I could write that. You know what I mean? Like, it just,
I do.
So little that you're like, wow, that's insane. And I want to do that.
Yeah.
And of course I never do, but.
Very few of us do.
But that's all right. That's all right. No, Michael Hawley does. He does.
Well, speaking of that, okay. One of my fiction novels, I have my protagonist and antagonist. They are in like a chess game, and my nephew, who's you know, in his 40s, just loved it until at the end I blew everything up. So I went back to America and I blew it all up, and so he goes, I loved it. It was my favorite book until you blew everything up. Oh, well.
It was all good until then.
Well, that's right.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on. It's been
I really appreciate you having me.
It's always fascinating talking to other authors and finding out stuff and kind of how they do things, right. And it's good conversation. So the newest book, of course, is called The Poisoned Pawn,
right.
Sherlock Holmes Adventure. And the writer has been our guest. I want to thank you.
Thank you.
Richard T. Ryan.
Michael, it was a pleasure meeting you.
Oh, you as well. It was great.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This is a production of Sunfield Media.
I'll be back.
KCAA, where every day is a great day. KCAA, Loma Linda.
How you doing? This is Gary Garver. In today's society, the majority of people are not getting enough sleep. I know I'm not. If you're like me and having problems getting a good night's rest, whether it's health or stress related, I have a solution for you. South Pacific Sleep Lab. South Pacific Sleep Lab will do an evaluation of your sleep pattern and will provide a comprehensive study so you can start getting a restful, peaceful night of sleep. They take all types of insurance, which will cover your cost of the evaluation, and they will even provide transportation to their offices at no cost to you. For more information, contact Tony at 310-999-1887. That's 310-999-1887. Tony even stays awake all night, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, so you can sleep better and rest easy. South Pacific Sleep Lab. Start feeling better and getting a great night of sleep today.
For several years, KCAA has been marketing the Youngevity brand of nutritional and personal care products. Our experience with Youngevity has been 100% positive, so we are pleased to recommend them to you. Regarding nutritional supplements, we recommend Pollen Burst in the berry flavor and Tangy Tangerine 2.0 in the tablet form. For regularity issues, we recommend 3-Day Cleanse. And for personal care, we recommend Morning Hydration Cream. You can shop online for Youngevity at www.kcaateam.com. Or you can order by phone by calling 800-982-3197 and tell customer support that you are part of the KCAA team. Youngevity is an American company based in San Diego. Call Youngevity at 800-982-3197 and ask about monthly auto ship that allows you to buy Youngevity products at wholesale prices. That number again, 800-982-3197.
Tejibo Tea Club's original Pure Pau de Arco Super Tea helps build red corpuscles in the blood, which carry oxygen to our organs and cells. Our organs and cells need oxygen to regenerate themselves. The immune system needs oxygen to develop, and cancer dies in oxygen. So the tea is great for healthy people because it helps build the immune system, and it can truly be miraculous for someone fighting a potentially life-threatening disease due to an infection, diabetes, or cancer. The tea is also organic and naturally caffeine-free. A one-pound package of tea is $49.95, which includes shipping. To order, please visit TejiboTeaClub.com. Tejibo is spelled T like Tom, A-H-E-E-B like boy, O, then continue with the word tea and then the word club. The complete website is TejiboTeaClub.com or call us at 818-610-8088, Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. California time. That's 818-610-8088, TejiboTeaClub.com.
10:50 a.m. Don't forget that number. And for you young people who got here by accidentally fat-fingering your FM band selector, we're an AM radio station, and AM refers to more than just the time of day.
I'm Rick Smith, host of The Rick Smith Show, inviting you to listen to my show during the noon hour every weekday right here on KCAA. My show is sponsored locally by Teamsters 1932. a strong union with 14,000 members in the IE. Our message is clear. Unions improve the lives of working people. You have a right to form and join a union, so go to Teamsters1932.org and get started now.
You're on board KCAA's Inland Talk Express. KCAA, Loma Linda, 1050 AM, the station that leaves no listener behind.
Are you ready to change your life?